Later on, as a middle-aged optometrist, he would weep quietly and privately sometimes, but never make loud boo-hooing noises. Which is why the epigraph of this book is the quatrain from the famous Christmas Carol. Billy cried very little, though he often saw things worth crying about, and in that respect, at least, he resembled the Christ of the carol. The cattle are lowing, the baby awakes, but the little Lord Jesus, no crying he makes. Billy traveled in time back to the hospital in Vermont. Breakfast had been eaten and cleared away, and Professor Rumford was reluctantly becoming interested in Billy as a human being. Rumford questioned Billy gruffly, satisfied himself that Billy really had been in Dresden. He asked Billy what it had been like, and Billy told him about the horses and the couple picnicking on the moon. The story ended this way. Billy and the doctors unharnessed the horses, but the horses wouldn't go anywhere. Their feet hurt too much. And then Russians came on motorcycles, and they arrested everybody but the horses. 2 days after that, Billy was turned over to the Americans, who shipped him home on a very slow freighter called the Lucretia A. Mott. Lucretia A. Mott was a famous American suffragette. She was dead. So it goes.
"It had to be done,"
Rumford told Billy, speaking of the destruction of Dresden. "I know," said Billy.
"That's war."
"I know. I'm not complaining."
"It must have been hell on the ground."
"It was," said Billy Pilgrim.
"Pity the men who had to do it."
"I do."
"You must have mixed feelings there on the ground."
"It was all right," said Billy. "Everything is all right, and everybody has to do exactly what he does. I learned that on Tralfamador." Billy Pilgrim's daughter took him home later that day, put him to bed in his house, turned the magic fingers on. There was a practical nurse there. Billy wasn't supposed to work or even leave the house for a while, at least. He was under observation. But Billy sneaked out while the nurse wasn't watching, and he drove to New York City, where he hoped to appear on television. He was going to tell the world about the lessons of Tralfamador. Billy Pilgrim checked into the Royalton Hotel on 44th Street in New York. He, by chance, was given a room which had once been the home of George Jean Nathan, the critic and editor. Nathan, according to the Earthling concept of time, had died back in 1958. According to the Tralfamadorian concept, of course, Nathan was still alive somewhere and always would be. The room was small and simple, except that it was on the top floor and had French doors which opened onto a terrace as large as the room. And beyond the parapet of the terrace was the airspace over 44th Street. Billy now leaned over that parapet, looked down at all the people moving hither and yon. They were jerky little scissors. They were a lot of fun. It was a chilly night, and Billy came indoors after a while, closed the French doors. Closing those doors reminded him of his honeymoon. There had been French doors on the Cape Ann love nest of his honeymoon, still were, always would be. Billy turned on his television set, clicking its channel selector around and around. He was looking for programs on which he might be allowed to appear. But it was too early in the evening for programs that allowed people with peculiar opinions to speak out. It was only a little after 8 o'clock, so all the shows were about silliness or murder. So it goes. Billy left his room, went down the slow elevator, walked over to Times Square, looked into the window of a tawdry bookstore. In the window were hundreds of books about fucking and buggery and murder, and a street guide to New York City, and a model of the Statue of Liberty with a thermometer on it. Also in the window, speckled with soot and fly shit, were four paperback novels by Billy's friend, Kilgore Trout. The news of the day, meanwhile, was being written in a ribbon of lights on a building to Billy's back. The window reflected the news. It was about power and sports and anger and death. So it goes. Billy went into the bookstore. A sign in there said that adults only were allowed in the back. There were peep shows in the back that showed movies of young women and men with no clothes on. It cost a quarter to look into a machine for 1 minute. There were still photographs of naked young people for sale back there, too. You could take those home. The stills were a lot more Tralfamadorian than the movies, since you could look at them whenever you wanted to, and they wouldn't change. 20 years in the future, those girls would still be young, would still be smiling or smoldering or simply looking stupid with their legs wide open. Some of them were eating lollipops or bananas. They would still be eating those, and the peckers of the young men would still be semi-erect, and their muscles would be bulging like cannonballs. But Billy Pilgrim wasn't beguiled by the back of the store. He was thrilled by the Kilgore Trout novels in the front. The titles were all new to him, or he thought they were. Now he opened one. It seemed all right for him to do that. Everybody else in the store was pawing things. The name of the book was The Big Board. He got a few paragraphs into it, and then realized that he had read it before, years ago, in the Veterans Hospital. It was about an earthling man and woman who were kidnapped by extraterrestrials. They were put on display in a zoo on a planet called Zircon 212. These fictitious people in the zoo had a big board supposedly showing stock market quotations and commodity prices along one wall of their habitat, and a news ticker and a telephone that was supposedly connected to a brokerage on Earth. The creatures on Zircon 212 told their captives that they had invested $1 million for them back on Earth, that it was up to the captives to manage it so they would be fabulously wealthy when they were returned to Earth. The telephone and the big board and the ticker were all fakes, of course. They were simply stimulants to make the earthlings perform vividly for the crowds at the zoo, to make them jump up and down and cheer or gloat or sulk or tear their hair, to be scared shitless or to feel as contented as babies in their mother's arms. The earthlings did very well on paper. That was part of the rigging, of course. And religion got mixed up in it, too. The news ticker reminded them that the President of the United States had declared National Prayer Week and that everybody should pray. The earthlings had had a bad week on the market before that. They had lost a small fortune in olive oil futures, so they gave praying a whirl. It worked. Olive oil went up. Another Kilgore Trout book there in the window was about a man who built a time machine so he could go back and see Jesus. It worked, and he saw Jesus when Jesus was only 12 years old. Jesus was learning the carpentry trade from his father. Two Roman soldiers came into the shop with a mechanical drawing on papyrus of a device they wanted built by sunrise the next morning. It was a cross to be used in the execution of a rabble-rouser. Jesus and his father built it. They were glad to have the work, and the rabble-rouser was executed on it. So it goes. The bookstore was run by seeming quintuplets, by five short, bald men chewing unlit cigars that were sopping wet. They never smiled, and each one had a stool to perch on. They were making money running a paper and celluloid whorehouse. They didn't have hard-ons. Neither did Billy Pilgrim. Everybody else did. It was a ridiculous store, all about love and babies. The clerks occasionally told somebody to buy or get out, not to just look and look and look and paw and paw. Some of the people were looking at each other instead of the merchandise. A clerk came up to Billy and told him the good stuff was in the back, that the books Billy was reading were window dressing. "That ain't what you want, for Christ's sake," he told Billy. "What you want's in back." So Billy moved a little farther back, but not as far as the part for adults only. He moved because of absent-minded politeness, taking a Trout book with him, the one about Jesus and the time machine. The time traveler in the book went back to Bible times to find out one thing in particular, whether or not Jesus had really died on the cross, or whether he had been taken down while still alive, whether he had really gone on living. The hero had a stethoscope along. Billy skipped to the end of the book, where the hero mingled with the people who were taking Jesus down from the cross. The time traveler was the first one up the ladder, dressed in clothes of the period, and he leaned close to Jesus so people couldn't see him use the stethoscope, and he listened. There wasn't a sound inside the emaciated chest cavity. The Son of God was dead as a doornail. So it goes. The time traveler, whose name was Lance Corwin, also got to measure the length of Jesus, but not to weigh him. Jesus was 5 feet and 3.5 inches long. Another clerk came up to Billy and asked him if he was going to buy the book or not, and Billy said that he wanted to buy it, please. He had his back to a rack of paperback books about oral genital contacts from ancient Egypt to the present and so on, and the clerk supposed Billy was reading one of these, so he was startled when he saw what Billy's book was. He said, "Jesus Christ, where did you find this thing?" and so on, and he had to tell the other clerks about the pervert who wanted to buy the window dressing. The other clerks already knew about Billy. They had been watching him, too. The cash register where Billy waited for his change was near a bin of old girly magazines. Billy looked at one out of the corner of his eye, and he saw this question on its cover. What really became of Montana Wild Hack? So Billy read it. He knew where Montana Wild Hack really was, of course. She was back on Tralfamador, taking care of the baby, but the magazine, which was called Midnight Pussycats, promised that she was wearing a cement overcoat under 30 fathoms of salt water in San Pedro Bay. So it goes. Billy wanted to laugh. The magazine, which was published for lonesome men to jerk off to, ran the story so it could print pictures taken from blue movies which Montana had made as a teenager. Billy did not look closely at these. They were grainy things, soot and chalk. They could have been anybody. Billy was again directed to the back of the store, and he went this time. A jaded sailor stepped away from a movie machine while the film was still running. Billy looked in, and there was Montana Wild Hack, alone in a bed, peeling a banana. The picture clicked off. Billy did not want to see what happened next, and the clerk importuned him to come over and see some really hot stuff they kept under the counter for connoisseurs. Billy was mildly curious as to what could possibly have been kept hidden in such a place. The clerk leered and showed him. It was a photograph of a woman and a Shetland pony. They were attempting to have sexual intercourse between two Doric columns in front of velvet draperies, which were fringed with deedly balls. Billy didn't get onto television in New York that night, but he did get onto a radio talk show. There was a radio station right next to Billy's hotel. He saw its call letters over the entrance of an office building, So he went in. He went up to the studio on an automatic elevator, and there were other people up there waiting to go in. They were literary critics, and they thought Billy was one too. They were going to discuss whether the novel was dead or not. So it goes. Billy took his seat with the others around a golden oak table with a microphone all his own. The master of ceremonies asked him his name and what paper he was from. Billy said he was from the Ilium Gazette. He was nervous and happy. "If you're ever in Cody, Wyoming," he told himself, "just ask for Wild Bob." Billy put his hand up at the very first part of the program, but he wasn't called on right away. Others got in ahead of him. One of them said that it would be a nice time to bury the novel, now that a Virginian, 100 years after Appomattox, had written Uncle Tom's Cabin. Another one said that people couldn't read well enough anymore to turn print into exciting situations in their skulls, so that authors had to do what Norman Mailer did, which was to perform in public what he had written. The master of ceremonies asked people to say what they thought the function of the novel might be in modern society, and one critic said, "to provide touches of color in rooms with all white walls." Another one said, "to describe blowjobs artistically." Another one said, "to teach wives of junior executives what to buy next and how to act in a French restaurant." And then Billy was allowed to speak. Off he went, in that beautifully trained voice of his, telling about the flying saucers and Montana wild hack, and so on. He was gently expelled from the studio during a commercial. He went back to his hotel room, put a quarter into the Magic Fingers machine connected to his bed, and he went to sleep. He traveled in time back to Tralfamador. "Time traveling again," said Montana. It was artificial evening in the dome. She was breastfeeding their child. Said Billy. "You've been time traveling again. I can always tell. Where did you go this time? It wasn't the war. I can tell that too. New York, the Big Apple." That's what they used to call New York. "Oh, you see any plays or movies?" "No. I walked around Times Square some. Bought a book by Kilgore Trout." "Lucky you." She did not share his enthusiasm for Kilgore Trout. Billy mentioned casually that he had seen part of a blue movie she had made. Her response was no less casual. It was Tralfamadorian and guilt-free. "Yes," she said, "and I've heard about you in the war, about what a clown you were. And I've heard about the high school teacher who was shot. He made a blue movie with a firing squad." She moved the baby from one breast to the other because the moment was so structured that she had to do so. There was a silence. "They're playing with the clocks again," said Montana, rising, preparing to put the baby into its crib. She meant that their keepers were making the electric clocks in the dome go fast, then slow, then fast again, and watching the little earthling family through peepholes. There was a silver chain around Montana Wild Hack's neck. Hanging from it, between her breasts, was a locket containing a photograph of her alcoholic mother, a grainy thing, soot and chalk. It could have been anybody. Engraved on the outside of the locket were these words: "God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom always to tell the difference."